Well, good evening. Looks like everybody's here. It's really nice. We're on page 47, is that right? 56. Oh, we haven't done the sifting the rice yet, have we? Number 21.
One evening, he said, in the meditation cloisters of China, it happens that they sift their wheat and rice and such, getting rid of the bad and taking the good, make it into cooked rice or whatever. A certain meditation teacher criticized this in a verse, saying, even though your head be broken into seven pieces, do not sift the rice. His meaning was that monks should not arrange vegetarian meals or the like. Depending on what there is, they should eat the food when it is good, and when it is bad, they should eat it without disgust. It is just a matter of using the faithful donations of patrons and the pure and clean food from the temple provisions to ward off hunger and support life to practice the way. It means that one should not choose between good and bad on the basis of taste. The members of my congregation now should also have such a mind.
I thought about this, that last year this would seem very far out in a world, our world of such plenty. We get to choose and become very picky about what we have, what we get, what comes to us. Now, when things are getting tight and we don't have so many choices, many people are accepting things they would never have dreamed of accepting before. Dogen is pointing to that luscious world where we're so busy picking and choosing that we lose our actual connection with how things are. It reminds me that Suzuki Roshi talked about choosing fruits and vegetables at the grocery store, and how he always took the bruised ones, the ones that he knew wouldn't be chosen by anybody. Coben did that too. That what comes to us, we take for granted in a certain way. And in a life of practice, we can allow ourselves to drop that attachment also. This question of criteria, one should not choose between good and bad on the basis of taste. So on what basis should we choose between good and bad? I think that's really the point of what he's saying. We do have to choose. We need very, very discriminating minds in order to make our way through this world and stay open to it. What do you think?
Well, it kind of reminded me of like what our approach of zazen kind of should be, like the notion of choiceless awareness. And despite the tastes that we're getting, the different thoughts coming in our heads, a lot of it just to try and occupy ourselves from actually being in the moment. In Zazen, we're sitting. So we have to, that's, I guess, the decision to make, or sit straight.
Sit up and allow whatever is coming to come.
And not get it, not dig a further hole. Or
yes, not expect to be entertained. Or look for the exciting parts and try to get rid of the boring parts. Yeah.
Sometimes, lately I've been, experiencing a bit of a pain in my sitting. A little, and it's really interesting kind of becoming aware of how much feeding into it, but when I just don't judge it, or, maybe, kind of picking the bruised fruit, the pain is, it's not perfect, but it's, I'm not at least adding to it.
Yes, that's the idea, that's the point, yeah.
I think we also have to choose and make decisions, discriminations all the time, and it can feel really so contingent and so unsure. I'm thinking of associating with somebody we think is maybe not such a good person, and it can feel like it's a mistake to go along with somebody who you don't think is that good, but I don't know whether that's even a point. I guess sometimes it is a point. You need to think whether it's a mistake or not, but what I'm thinking about right now is that feeling of at any given moment you could stop and think, what am I doing? Is this the right thing to be doing?
Yes.
And at any given moment you could say to yourself, I should be doing the exact opposite. And I think that's kind of a neutral thing, really. I just think that is how it is. To hold the course in something that feels uncomfortable like that, really uncomfortable, because it's so ambiguous. I believe that's a good part of our experience.
Yes, it certainly can be. Seems to me, in terms of bodhisattva practice, that the choices that we make are for our own and others' benefit. So if we get caught up in a situation where we're liking it or not liking it without having a sense of why we're there and what it's serving. And if it's not serving anything except if it's a caught place, maybe there was a reason to be there at first, but then the reason gets lost in the shuffle somehow. We often get into situations like that and think we can't even get out of it. It's just so natural by that time. I think it's really important to be able to step back and look very objectively at the situations that we're in, all of them. And sometimes, as we acknowledge that it's a really rotten one, to see why we're there and what it serves. And sometimes it's a good idea to stay there. If you're there for a beneficial reason, a wholesome reason. And sometimes it's very important to, if you see clearly that you're caught, to get uncaught as quickly as possible. If it's not serving, you or your world, the world that you support, then you need to be where you can support and be useful and helpful. That sounds simple, but of course we're constantly trying to figure out which is which, and it's really hard. Really hard. And sometimes it's one way and sometimes it's another.
I think that's what I'm...
The ambiguity.
Yeah, just the... I mean, with it at word, you could discern it back clearly. Maybe you've gone along far enough and it becomes quite clear.
Yeah.
So often it's not. And just the...
Well, I think if it's not, if it's the so often it's not point, that it's like any question that you can't find an answer to. You just have to wait. Wait for it to get ripe and tell you what to do. I think mostly we're in that position, or so many times, when we don't quite know what to do, and we just have to wait until we're moved. But the more conscious we are of the whole, as much of the picture of what we're in as we can see, the more helpful it is. And the more I think that whatever is cooking in us and bringing up to us the answer needs as much objective information as possible. Objective insight into what's really going on. And that supports us in a way. It also helps to get other people's point of view about a situation. It helps to get that perspective that we can't really have in the middle of the soup. We're too much a part of it. A struggle.
In terms of action, I mean, when the answer, you know, I mean, there's a clearing. I mean, usually, I guess I'm torn between thinking, well, ambiguity is just kind of the way things
mm-hmm.
are, but then on the other hand, there's been times where things feel pretty clear, but there's been times when I've been wrong on both on both ends. I don't know. It's like it isn't
one mistake after another.
I don't even know if you could say it's a mistake. I guess it's just like, I mean, I think perception is inherently, there's inherently a weak link there. I mean, and I guess you don't.
Just have to feel your way along. We look back and see what happened, but when we're in the middle of it, we don't really know. We're just doing it. Doing the best we can. As clearly as we can, as self-knowing as we can. Knowing the situation, knowing ourself, and then allowing ourselves not to know what's going to happen next. Shall we go on to the next one?
Number 22. As someone asked, if a student hearing that one's own self is the Buddha way and that one should not seek outside, who deeply believe in these words, abandon his former practice and study, and spend his lifetime doing good or evil deeds according to his basic nature, how is this understanding?
Dogen said, misunderstanding the words and the principle of contradiction. If on a premise one should not seek outwardly the varying practice and the evil study, it seems like there is something sought by this practice which is abandoned. This is that not seeking.
Just realize that practice and study are fundamentally the Buddha way itself, without any object of seeking. Even if in your heart you want to do things like the evil deeds of the world, do not do them, and do not weary or take notice of the boredom of the practical exercise of the study of the way. On the basis of this practice, cultivating it single-mindedly, it is when you carry on without any quest from your own mind, even as to fulfilling the way or obtaining the result, that you would be in conformity with the principle that you should not seek outwardly.
Manuwe's polishing a tile to make a mirror also was admonishing Matsu's quest to become a Buddha. It is not that he prescribed sitting meditation. Sitting is itself the act of a Buddha. Sitting is itself non-doing. This is just one's own true body. The thing is that you should not seek a special way to enlightenment beyond this.
Let's read the note on page 53.
Yes, Wang Jing of Nanyu visited his future disciple Ma Tsutao Ai and found the latter sitting constantly in meditation. Nanyu asked him, "What are you striving for by sitting in meditation?" Ma Tsu said, "I am striving to become a Buddha." Nanyu then picked up a piece of tile and began to rub it on a rock. Ma Tsu asked him what he was doing, and he said, "I am polishing the tile to make a mirror." Ma Tsu asked, "How can you polish a tile to make a mirror?" Nanyu said, "Granted that polishing a tile will not make it a mirror, how can sitting in meditation produce a Buddha?"
Kind of what you were saying, Julian. That's a very famous old story. Yes, one of the greatest hits, old Zen stories. This is like the beatnik Zen that I first knew when I moved to San Francisco. And there were some poets who heard about Zen. Alan Watts was teaching it then. And they had exactly this idea, just precisely, that if the Buddha way, if the one's own self is the Buddha way, that one should not seek outside, then anything goes. That this is it, and we can do anything we want to because we're Buddha already. It took Suzuki Roshi's arriving and becoming available that disabused people of this idea. And of course, it gave them no satisfaction at all. They were just kind of playing at something without understanding it. And Dogen says, it seems like there is something sought by this practice, the practice of seeking outwardly, which is abandoned. You're abandoning practice as soon as you look somewhere else. Say, oh, this is me, I'm all enlightened, and so now I'm going to go out and do something else. And practice gets left behind. What we do is so simple that it's hard to believe that it could be it, that this indeed is what we're looking for. And I like that he notices, he mentions that weariness and boredom in exercising the study of the way is a part of it too. It's like what I was saying last week, that we have a hard time allowing ourselves to be simple, allowing ourselves to be bored, not wanting to somehow give ourselves a jolt. And it's not that it's one way or the other, as Jane was pointing out. There's an in-between place in it. But to find the quiet in practice, the quiet place of it, the place in which we rest, is where what we call boredom is. Once we get there, it isn't boring at all. But in contrast, it can seem to be. So carry on without any quest from your own mind. As to fulfilling the way or obtaining the result, that you would be in conformity with the principle that you should not seek outwardly. We're already in conformity with the principle. Already.
In the Sandokai, Suzuki talks about, wait, I forgot the syllable, like G, the...
Oh, yes, G and Re.
Yes, G is the one that comes before Re, or did I...
I always forget.
Okay, well, if I remember correctly, there's like the... that thing that comes before forms, and that seems to be pointing to that as well. Like Buddha way, it's already, like, once it's escaped your mouth, almost it's like
it's the whole theory. Yes, yeah. As soon as we talk about it, then we're turning it into something
other.
Yeah. So it's in the untalkaboutable realm.
to the frustrations of many.
Yes, yes, it's very hard. But to sort it out in that way, the way he does in that book about Sandokai, branching streams in the darkness, so that you can actually feel how we reify things, make them into something with our mind. And how, if we really think about it, it's not there. It's just an idea. All of Sandokai is about that. It's really form and emptiness. Now, form doesn't differ from emptiness. Emptiness doesn't differ from form. It's a very awkward way of saying, you know, it's already. Therefore, we practice. That's our paradox. That's how we do form and emptiness. Anything else? Oh, there's too much in the next one.
Talking about it, it's so interesting because sitting in itself has an organic form for me. And it's also the talk that helps validate. Have an ongoing discussion with Peter at Chikoji. You know, how does talk supplement the practice? Mm-hmm. How does form supplement our sitting? And it's it almost gets down to taste, which I love that metaphor in the previous one, too. It's, you know, some people like Brussels sprouts and some people don't. That's kind of simplistically looking at it. It's very, it's a preference. Mm-hmm. We're comfortable with that.
So Peter's the not talking one? I see. He's on a committee in which he won't talk.
Committee, so,
yeah. I see.
He asked about, you know, came up whether to have discussions or classes. He says, no. He's the focus.
Uh-huh.
It's also very interesting.
Yeah.
It comes down to the individual.
Relationship with our
teacher. Mm-hmm. Huh. Samia? They're not discussing, isn't that kind of when you get to a point where maybe one doesn't need that? It feels like at the beginning, you know, a baby needs to eat every 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know, and scream and yell, eat, stupid thing. You know, it just feels like it's needed. So
I think
I don't understand.
I think you're right. Well, encouragement, except that I always say not to read in those even in the first year of learning to sit. That reading really is a distraction because it's just ideas And the whole point of sitting is to drop out of our ideas. But it's very important to have a teacher and to have some words from the teacher, some kind of encouraging word. The teacher doesn't teach anything, but the teacher confirms, as you say, and encourages and offers a safe place to bring one's questions and doubts and fears and all of the things that arise as we begin to sit. And in that sense, I think the talking is really important. And this also, I think, because we, each of us, come with our issues, our life, and often it's very helpful to talk about it. And talk about it together in the context of Zazen itself. But you're right, some people like apples and some people like Brussels sprouts. So Peter must be a, I don't know, an exotic fruit of some kind.
The talking still is not the thing. I mean, not that it isn't helpful. But
exactly, it's not the thing.
And no matter how you
Yes. Yeah, ultimately, Peter is right.
Just,
Yeah, but in the relative sense, it's sometimes needed. You know. I've forgotten what it's called. There's a self-enlightened person. Somebody who never had a teacher and never had a sangha who just somehow got it. And that's defined in the sutras as a particular kind of practicer. But a very unusual and rare one, that most people connect with a teacher and a sangha. And the Buddha Dharma Sangha is the life of a practicing person. All three. Ritu.
So there are people around who don't have a meditation practice or Zen practice or any practice, but they read a lot and talk a lot.
Yes.
How can I have strength to?
How can you stand it?
To understand it, I guess. Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's these words and these things, and that's why I want to focus on me, because to me they're very dear words and ideas, and they're it's kind of like feels a little assaulted,
yeah,
you know, and exoticized, and
yeah,
you know, meditation's so great, helps me feel like all the things that I say, and I, you know, it's the things we talk about makes life easier, makes it's a little different.
Yes, yes. I think you just can bow. And what was it, the story in the sutras about the guy who was drunk and tried on somebody else's kesa? He wasn't even a priest or a monk. He just ran around with it playing. And Buddha said, don't worry about it. That was good for him. He'll get it. Somehow he's getting it already. So I think it's fine. Just don't take it too seriously.
I'm saying, I am fine with the other person, but why is it? Maybe that's the question. Why does it feel so violating?
It is a kind of violation of your own deep feeling and understanding of it. But you can honor that and just, you know, it's like looking at a cartoon. There's some truth in it, but it's just not the same.